law school, baby. It all starts here.
Caleb Parsons is 6'9 swingman. You can shoot the three.
This is why you don't teach lessons.
Exactly.
UF basketball fans are terrible and shameful.
Hello and welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast. This is a show for Saturday, March 28th, 2009. I'm Adam Berry, the assistant sports editor and softball beat writer for Alligator Sports, once again podcasting from my living room. And joining me today are
Evan Drexler, sports editor and football beat writer.
Kyle Maestri, baseball beat writer.
And that's it. A little bit of a small show tonight.
We are depleted. We're down several men.
We're running the three-man weave here. So lot to talk about today. We're going to start off with the big news of the day, the Billy Donovan stuff, all about Kentucky. We're going to move on, talk a little bit about the NCAA tournament, and wrap everything up with some talk about the football team's spring practice. But Evan, go ahead and explain the Billy Donovan situation to us.
So once again, just like 2 years ago, we've had rumors in the last couple of days about UF men's basketball coach Billy Donovan possibly going elsewhere, leaving Gainesville and going someplace. Last time it was to the Orlando Magic, and this time it was possibly to Kentucky. All weekend long, it was Billy Gillespie, Kentucky's head coach, is getting fired for sure, and Billy Donovan is going to be his replacement. Multiple people had blogged this, but there was never any real concrete confirmation of it. The Fox outlet in Orlando confirmed it with sources that Billy had accepted an offer in principle with Kentucky. But then about half an hour after that, while all the football people are standing out in the rain at football practice, their cell phones all started lighting up because they have internet access on their phones, unlike me. With a statement from a men's basketball spokesman, Fred Demarest, from Billy Donovan, saying that Billy is committed to the University of Florida and he is not going anywhere and he's not interested in any kind of Kentucky job, and it's all just rumor. So basically, after 2 days of speculation about where Billy D would wind up, it appears he is staying in Gainesville and coaching with the Gators.
Do we feel like that settles it, though? Like, I mean, he still has to, I think, April 1st, you know, to make a permanent decision or whatever. So how do we feel about that?
Well, the thing with April 1st is he had from March 1st to April 1st to go elsewhere and explore their options without losing any kind of incentive on his contract. And once April 1st comes, then he takes like a $400,000 hit or something to that nature. I don't know the exact number. But at this point, I think he's pretty secure here. I didn't believe in the rumors to begin with. I thought it was kind of ludicrous that he would think about betraying Florida after what happened with Orlando 2 years ago. I thought he was pretty safe here. But, I mean, things change all the time in the sports world, and we could see for all, you know, we'll wake up on Sunday morning and see Billy Donovan coaching at Western Michigan for all we know. So, you know, things are never 100%, but I feel pretty confident saying Billy's going to be a Gators coach next year.
Yeah, I have conflicting, ideas or opinions when stuff like this happens, because on one hand, I think it's not really fair to Donovan, because in this situation, he has to do literally nothing for these headlines to be made. Mm-hmm. Like, just the fact that the Kentucky job came open, he's always going to be associated with that job while he is alive and able to coach. And it's kind of like the same thing whenever Notre Dame comes open, you're going to see Urban Meyer's name come up, and that's just how it's going to be for them.
Yeah, it's completely fueled by media.
Exactly. So it has nothing to do with Donovan even saying that he has any interest. So on the one hand, it's a little bit unfair to those guys when these type of things happen. On the other hand, I don't really trust Billy Donovan too much, or at least I'm skeptical when any of these, you know, standard issue statements are released saying, I'm committed to building the program, but it never explicitly says, I'm not going to take the Kentucky job. You know, it's always like kind of beating around the bush.
Yeah.
And especially after the whole Magic debacle went down, it's kind of hard to take him exactly at his word, because, you know, even when the ink's dried with him, he may go back on it and change his mind. So I'm not trying to condemn Billy Donovan. I'm just saying you got to wait till the dust settles on stories like this.
When it's a little hard to take statements like that seriously, and when, what was it, Thursday night, we're sitting there watching TV and we see, like, the University of Kentucky has not announced the firing of Billy Gillespie.
Right.
You know, at this point, no press conference will be held tomorrow.
Right.
Then the next day, fired, you know, and everything like that.
Right.
So.
And we started hearing these rumors about Billy Donovan possibly succeeding Gillespie at Kentucky on Thursday morning, and There's really a fine line between Billy Donovan coming out and making a statement like this, like he did on Friday afternoon. How long does he have to wait before making a statement? Because he doesn't want to acknowledge silly rumors, but then he doesn't also want them to spiral completely out of control like they were starting to do on Friday. So it was a lot of matter of timing, and it took him a day and a half, but he finally decided, you know, enough is enough, and I'm going to put out a statement.
Well, I think the silly part of it is saying that you're not interested in a job that hasn't yet opened.
Yeah.
So I think he actually did the right thing. He waited until the job actually opened and there was a real possibility of it, whether or not he had been in contact with Kentucky or not. And then, you know, he promptly delivered a reaction to it. So I think that was good, and he did that well. But I think a lot of it comes down to the media, and I don't want to, like, badmouth the media since we're all a part of it.
Yeah.
But everyone wants to be the first person to break the story, break the huge news, who's going to get it first. And I don't think the repercussions or outrage is maybe hard enough for a news outlet like the Orlando Fox affiliate, the TV affiliate,
mm-hmm.
who broke the story with sources that he took the job and it was a done deal. Like,
that he agreed in principle.
Like, I don't really know what should happen to them, but like, it sucks that you have to go through that. And one of my friends called me and was like, oh, they have it in Orlando. I was like, does Jeremy Fowler have it? Like, who has it? I don't understand. They're like, no, the TV station. I'm like, well, this is ridiculous.
TV
like,
station that doesn't cover men's basketball day to day.
Exactly. Like, it's not like it's a beat writer who's out here. I just don't get it. And it really sucks that that's the kind of environment. It just makes it worse with the blogging atmosphere that we're in these days, because anyone can put their opinions on the internet without leaving their couch or talking to anyone. And
that's not to say blogs are bad.
No. Yeah, blogs are not inherently bad, but it just gives anyone a voice. So it's a little bit, you know, you have to pick and choose a little more carefully.
And it's really a snowball effect when one person blogs it and then the other person blogs and they have to try to find a source, and they say they have some kind of source who's close to it, and there's message boards and people are blogging about plane tracking numbers that are leaving the Gainesville airport and landing in Lexington, Kentucky, and then going to Notre Dame where Kentucky basketball is playing an NIT game.
Right.
So there's just a lot of stuff that people find and put online, and Billy Donovan eventually decided on Friday afternoon to put a statement out quelling any rumors.
Do we all agree that was the right time? I mean, I absolutely think it was well timed.
Something needed to be said Friday because of how crazy things were getting with the Fox News station supposedly breaking the news.
Assuming he doesn't actually go ahead and take the job now, I think he handled it well. Yeah. Like, to this point, I think he's handled it very well. But I think realistically, one thing I wanted to ask you guys, do we think that Kentucky is even a better job than Florida at this point? I'm really not so sure.
I don't, personally, but go ahead, Evan.
We had discussion about this a couple podcasts ago about where Florida is historically as a program, and obviously it isn't anywhere close to Kentucky historically as a program. And I don't know, both of these programs are in a position currently after the 2008-2009 season where it's like a rebuilding mode. I mean, they have some core pieces there, but you don't know what to expect from Kentucky basketball next year. You don't know what to expect from Florida basketball next year. If Calathis stays, if Jody Meek stays, I mean, there's just too many factors in there, and I don't think Kentucky is necessarily a better job than Florida now.
You can recruit at both places, and historically you may be able to be remembered better having been a winner at Kentucky than having been a winner at Florida. But at the same time, ask Billy Gillespie about the expectations at Kentucky, and they're unfair, quite frankly. I mean, he got them in the tournament last year when I didn't think they were that great of a team. I thought they overachieved last year, and I thought he did a good job with them. Mm-hmm. This year, you can make the argument that maybe they underachieved slightly. But I wouldn't say they embarrassed themselves or they did anything particularly, you know, terrible, stuff like that.
Well, they didn't make the tournament for the first time in, what was it, 11 years. And in Kentucky, that's unacceptable.
Right.
I agree completely.
Right, yeah,
Billy
yeah.
Gillespie was completely...
But that's the thing.
They treated him wrong, firing him after 2 years.
You missed the tournament 1 year in Kentucky after 11 years, and you get fired. Billy Dees missed it twice here. And I know he's got a couple championships under his belt, but, like, I'm obviously, you know, the leash isn't as tight here at Florida. So, and honestly, I think that's a good thing. I think as a coach, you want that job security, because what happens if he leaves Florida, goes to Kentucky, they fill his position, and then Kentucky, you know, wrongly fires him after 2 years, you're going to have to go find another job.
Yeah, and that's a very real possibility if he were to do that. And I don't see why he would leave here. He has, you know, his guys coming in. He has the team. Next year, it looks like he might finally have the team that he's been wanting to have for the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't – it doesn't make sense for him. It doesn't make sense for some of the names they've been throwing around to replace Gillespie at Kentucky. You know, I just don't understand it, so.
Gillespie.
It's very late.
S before the T. But I think Gillespie was in the unfortunate position that of being after, you know, succeeding a coach who won national championships in Tubby Smith, the same position that Ron Zook was in after, you know, coming in after Steve Spurrier, the same position of whoever follows Donovan will be in and whoever follows Urban Meyer. You know, when you have success in a program and a coach and you lose, you know, you don't win national championships immediately or you don't compete immediately – the fan base is going to go nuts because they're used to national championships. They're used to being on the national scene.
And let's talk about some of the other coaching changes happening in the SEC right now. Kyle, tell me about some of those.
Yeah, there's a lot of Gators tie-in to a lot of the things going on right now. The Alabama job came open after the season was over. And Anthony Grant, who was an assistant under Billy Donovan for 10 years, he was on the staff for the first championship. Then he took the head coaching job at VCU. He led them to three Colonial Athletic Association regular season titles in a row. VCU became kind of a well-known program around the nation.
Beat Duke 2 years ago.
Yep, and he became a hot name, and he went ahead and took the Alabama job. It was announced today that he signed with them. And he becomes the second coach now in the SEC to have been an assistant under Billy Donovan. John Pelfrey is the other one who currently coaches at Arkansas. So it's, you can kind of see Billy Donovan creating his own tree that maybe falls under the Rick Pitino tree originally, but it's kind of cool what's going on in the SEC with former Florida assistant coaches.
All right, and there's a couple open jobs here. Georgia's still open, and then obviously Kentucky. Who do we feel like could be replacing those jobs?
Well, Georgia, I honestly have no idea. I'm not even going to pretend to speculate that I know what's going on with Georgia because they're not a basketball program, to be frank, and I haven't heard too many big names thrown out there for them. It could be a hire from within or something like that, a lesser-known coach.
Georgia, in all likelihood, will not be able to land a big-name coach just because they're not a basketball program. So in all likelihood, will be a name from within or from a smaller conference team.
Right. And Kentucky, though, you have a couple different names. One of them is Travis Ford, who's currently the coach at Oklahoma State. He was at UMass before that. He's had success at both programs, but they feel like he might be a little bit too young to take over the Kentucky job right now, a little bit too up-and-coming, hasn't established himself enough. The other names that we've kind of heard thrown out there, and I think these are more of a stretch, is John Calipari from Memphis and Tom Izzo from Michigan State. That one, I think, is the most ludicrous of the three. I can't possibly see Tom Izzo leaving Michigan State to go to Kentucky where, I mean, he's pretty much worshipped at Michigan State, so I don't see that happening.
And Calipari at Memphis, he said that he wasn't interested in the job. You know, it's interesting when you see jobs like this open and coaches saying no to the speculation before they're even offering. Right. He's just like, no, I'm not interested. I'm staying in Memphis. Mm-hmm. So
again, I don't know how much I believe that one way or another, but I think Kentucky is too proud of a university to hire a guy like Travis Ford, even though it makes a lot of sense. It's like He's been there. He had two head coaching jobs where he did very well, but like they don't see themselves as the type of program to take a chance on an up and comer. And like that's how I think of this situation. I think they think they deserve somebody more established, and we should just go buy the best guy out there. And I heard Dickie V say something ridiculous today that he thinks Kentucky.
Dickie V, something ridiculous.
Yeah, no. He thinks Kentucky should call Bob Knight, have him take the head coaching job, and bring on Ford as an assistant. With the understanding that Ford will take on the job after Bob Knight, leaves after 5 years or so, however much longer he can go.
There's no way Bob Knight will last five years.
And he'll be the coach in wait there under Bob Knight. So there's no chance that happens, but I thought that was really funny.
That's absurd.
The crazed ramblings of Dick Vitale.
Yeah. I want to ask a question I was talking about with some other people before. Do we feel like Kentucky is that kind of program where they do have that pull anymore, where they could pull an Izzo or a Calipari away? Are they really that relevant? Because I feel it's like with Notre Dame football is now, it's not, they're not in the spotlight. They're in the spotlight because of the history. They're not in the spotlight because of their performance.
Yeah, and I haven't heard any of these type names thrown out there, but I would think like a coach who has failed in the NBA and wants to drop down to the college ranks would be like a type of coach that they would hire. I'm not saying as a good or a bad thing, but it's like a big name that we've seen in the NBA who can't coach in the NBA anymore because they flamed out, and Kentucky goes and buys them up, kind of like USC did with Tim Floyd, where like he failed in the NBA, came back to the college ranks. So it's like they get their notoriety, but still it's not like somebody who is winning a bunch of championships. I don't know. I could see them doing something like that.
Yeah.
And, but no, I don't think they have the clout to pull someone away from another power program right now.
I think Adam's point is well taken in that the name is there, but the current situation is not. I mean, Kentucky 2 years ago, the name was there, and when they got rid of Tubby Smith and they managed to pull Gillespie away from, Texas A&M?
Yes, Texas A&M.
So, I mean, they still had some sway in that respect, but right now it doesn't seem to be that appealing of a job just on name recognition alone.
All right.
And the other thing I wanted to say was that Anthony Grant, you know, we talked about him briefly, but with him taking the job at Alabama, it's kind of interesting to see how his position has changed in the last couple seasons. If Billy Donovan would have taken that Kentucky job a couple years ago or the Magic job, he was, you know, going to be the guy here at UF.
And he was the only choice.
Right. And it just shows you how, like, timing is really everything in life and in getting jobs and in getting coaching jobs, because now he's at Alabama, which is same conference, but a huge step down from Florida. So I don't know how he feels, right? But yeah. kind of interesting to think, you know, what could have been or what would have been.
And it would have been interesting to see if Donovan had taken Kentucky this time and, you know, Grant couldn't have been hired here maybe.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised he didn't try to hold out to see if that happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of respect the guy for just committing straight up to Alabama and not running them around. But he may be kicking himself if Billy D goes back on what he said today and ends up going to Kentucky.
Or maybe he knows something we don't, more
right.
likely. So
yeah, he's a little more connected than us to Donovan, I would say.
He certainly made a name for himself at Virginia Commonwealth, and I think that's a good situation for him in Alabama. In the same way, you know, he can bring a program that isn't in the national recognition, he can bring it to prominence with a couple nice recruiting classes.
Mm-hmm. And another big job that's open, I just want to throw out there, is Arizona is going to be open now, and that's a huge, you know, powerhouse that somebody's going to have to take over. So not in the SEC, but a job to keep your eye on.
A powerhouse that should not have made the tournament, right, Kyle?
No, they absolutely should not have made the tournament.
But we'll they made the Sweet 16.
Speaking of the tournament, let's move on and talk a little bit about the NCAA tournament here. But first, let's talk about our bracket challenge we have going on at Alligator Sports. Currently atop the leaderboard is Benjamin Brunson, team name Red Saber, who is tied with Jonathan Holzinger, team name Jonathan Holzinger.
Very creative, Jonathan.
Much like my team name, Barry's team. So he and I are in a dead heat for most creative name.
No, mine's pretty bad. It's Alligator Sports, but that was chosen for me by the higher-ups at the Alligators. So.
At least yours isn't your name. Anyway, those two are tied, but Red Saber, Benjamin, has more possible points. So keep an eye on that as we're going along here. Games become worth more points. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. How are we doing, guys? What are your brackets looking like?
Well, Wake Forest killed me in the first round because I had them going to the Elite Eight, which obviously did not happen after tonight's games. But more recently, Memphis killed me on Thursday night because I had them going to the championship game and losing to Pitt. And I also got Syracuse wrong tonight, but I still have 5 of my 8 Elite Eights and 3 of the 4 Final Fours. So things could be worse for Evan Drexler's bracket, which is the one that you're trying to beat for the prizes. But if I were you, and you know, I'd be feeling pretty good because my bracket will leave room for about 45 people in front of me, I imagine.
Yeah, my bracket's looking pretty good actually right now. I have 6 of the 8 Elite Eight teams. The ones I missed were Michigan State. I had Dayton in that spot, of course. And Gonzaga I had over UNC. I'm really upset with Roy Williams. I feel duped and tricked because Ty Lawson looked far from hurt today in any sense of the word. But I have Oklahoma coming out of that region. So I have all my Final Fours intact still. They can all still happen. And
Oklahoma winning it?
I have Louisville winning it.
Against Oklahoma.
Against Oklahoma, yeah. And I'm currently behind Defer and McCall for our Alligator bracket. But McCall is a different winner than me. He has UNC, so that'll be settled that way. And Defer and I have very startlingly similar picks. We both have Louisville over Oklahoma. But the difference for us is going to hinge on the Villanova-Pitt game. I have Nova. He has Pitt. So I'm really excited for that game coming up.
All right, and just to clarify, Defer is in 12th place with 71 points, McCall is in 25th with 68, Kyle, you are in 33rd with 67, and Evan, 42nd with 66. And then coming in, rounding it up, is me with 65 points.
You're not rounding it up. There's 2 people behind you from the Alligator.
Well, yeah, but they have triple digits in their places.
Oh.
Ryan Steele's in 100th, and Phil, Mr. Brackets Kegler, is in 115th with 57 points.
Who's kind enough to not grace us with his presence tonight.
we'll talk about that a little bit later. Phil is actually 8 points behind me. I have 65. I also got screwed over by Memphis and Syracuse and... Gonzaga, I, you know, had the worst of both worlds going tonight, so, yeah, I'm not feeling too great about mine. Readers, I know you don't really care about beating me, but you probably will, so look forward to that in the future here. Let's talk about this weekend's games, what we've seen so far. Evan, you and I said that really the only exciting game we watched so far was Pitt Xavier, right?
I will go so far as to make a ridiculous claim that this was the most boring Sweet 16 ever. The games were decided by an average of 16.125 points. That's 16 and an eighth points. And, yeah,
good math.
I'm good with fractions like that.
In case you wanted a mixed number instead of a decimal.
Yeah,
that's what we're here for.
16 and an eighth points per game. And that's with two games being decided by 5 points. So there were 2 5-point games, and then it was the still average margin victory for the winning teams in the Sweet 16 was 16.125 points, which is just miserable. The only two games that were close at all were tonight's Kansas-Michigan State game and the Pittsburgh-Xavier game from Thursday night. And, you know, besides those two games, it was pretty much blowouts all around.
Yeah, Evan's completely right. It was pretty brutal. We've had some good games in the first weekend, and this was just really tough to watch for most of the time. And like you said, the two close games, the Michigan State-Kansas game, I couldn't care less about. I wasn't high on either of those teams, and I had them both going out wrongly in the round of 32, so that didn't matter for me. And I didn't have Xavier in the game against Pitt, and I only had Pitt going one more round, so that was cool. Vance Fields, you know, hit a big three at the end of the game there, got a steal and a layup. But it just – the two games I was looking forward to most, I think, this weekend were from the region with UNC as the number one seed. UNC Gonzaga game and the Syracuse-Oklahoma game, and both of those games were terrible to watch. Both huge blowouts, and it was just not good basketball this weekend.
And even one of the two games that was close, the Kansas-Michigan State game from Friday night, that game was over with a minute left because Michigan State was up 5 and had free throws in hand, so that game was pretty much over. And that was disappointing because we had Gus Johnson potential, and he was getting really excited with about 5 minutes left to go, but then he kind of, you know, tapered off as the game became very clearly in favor of Michigan State.
I'm not going to lie, I fell asleep shortly after halftime in that game. I didn't get a whole lot of sleep this week, and I was just not drawn in by, you know, any of the basketball.
And Kansas was up really early in that game by a fair amount, and Michigan State did a good job coming back to get the win.
Well, by far the poorest showing in the Sweet 16 was, of course, the Arizona Wildcats.
Yeah.
You know, when it came, we actually, on the preview NCAA podcast, we told you, if Arizona somehow gets into the Sweet 16, look out, it's going to be ugly against Louisville. And they managed to sneak their way in, and Louisville whooped them. They beat them by 39 points. They dropped 103 on them. Arizona looked completely uninterested with playing any sort of defense. And, they got past two mid-major teams. They beat Utah and Cleveland State, who pulled the upset to get there. And then when it came time to play one of the big boys, they just packed it in and went home. They said, okay, two games is enough. Let's go home and start, you know, doing whatever we do in the offseason, play some golf or something. But Arizona, I mean, you steal a spot from maybe a more deserving school, and then you don't even bother showing up in the Sweet 16. You should be ashamed of yourselves, frankly.
To say they didn't bother showing up, I mean, they were completely outmatched player for player.
If you watch that game at all, the defense was just unbelievable. Louisville was getting the most wide-open looks on every shot. People didn't even care to close out. Like, it was really just horrible, horrible basketball by Arizona. I'm not kidding. Like, I think there's just a few guys on that team that are supremely talented on the offensive end, and if they can't carry them offensively, they're never going to win games. Some of those guys will be gone to the NBA, where defense isn't required on most of those teams. They'll be great.
Are we really that surprised, though? I mean, in a year where, what, we have a 1-3, 2-1-3s and 2-1-2s, that the one, like, low seed, the 12 seed lost. Like, are we really surprised by that at all, though?
No, I mean, like we said before, you know, I said before the tournament started, we all said that if it were to happen, this is what was going to, you know, they were going to get beat down. But, you know, we've been trying to figure out why in recent years it's been so much chalk going into the Final Four, going into the championship game, and nobody really has a good answer as to why the favorites are winning more now than they have historically. And I think it has to do with the mid-major teams being more fairly ranked and fairly rated. Mm-hmm. I think they're getting the seeds they deserve now, so that when you get them as a 12, like, you used to get those teams who are now getting 6, 7, 8, 9 seeds as 12, 13, 14. And even if they weren't knocking off those teams in the first round, they were giving them one more really tough game that they shouldn't have had. So I think now it's a little more balanced, and it's a little bit easier for the high seeds to go because they're not having the surprise matchups in the beginning of the tournament, the first weekend.
All right, Evan, what do you think? Why are we seeing so much chalk? Is that what's making this tournament, you know, the Sweet 16 round, so boring to you as well?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's boring because we're not having any upsets. The last two national championship champions were one seeds, Florida and Kansas. And I really I couldn't tell you why these upsets aren't happening. I mean, you're used to seeing one crazy team go to at least the Sweet 16 and then have some fun in that round and maybe go to the Elite Eight, especially with the George Masons of the past. You know, we've gotten used to it. And I don't know, I guess we were just spoiled the last two years, in 05 and 06, with crazy teams getting far. And maybe our expectations were boosted a little unreasonably for future tournaments because the big boys are certainly taking care of business this year and last year.
I think maybe, I don't know how I feel about this. I'm testing out this theory on air here. I haven't had this talk with myself or others before this.
We're going to find so many reasons.
But with the rule now that you're not allowed to jump from high school to the NBA, you're getting some better talent in the college ranks for that 1 or 2 years that they end up staying that they wouldn't have before. And let's face it, they're not going to the little programs who are getting 10, 11, and 12 seeds. They're going to big programs for the most part. So maybe those teams are getting a little bit more talent, and it's less likely for them to be upset. I don't really know the answer to that. I'm just kind of throwing it out there.
That's a fairly good point. I hadn't really thought of that a whole lot, yeah.
I mean, it makes sense, but how many of those high school to NBA players are there in college basketball every year? I mean, 5 or 6 at the most, shoe wins for going straight from the high school to the NBA.
Well, let's say in each class there were 5 or 6 because you got guys who were going to jump to the NBA who maybe stay 2 years also. Mm-hmm. They end up liking the college experience or they find out that they can develop more. So, you know, maybe you get 15 or so guys around college basketball who fit that bill, and maybe that's enough to combine with the other factors like more fair seeding and stuff, and you're just seeing this perfect storm of a tournament nobody likes. It's like they're doing the right job, they're seeding them right, the big teams are winning, but that doesn't make for a good TV and excitement.
Is there anyone in particular you're thinking of for this theory of yours that you just tested?
Well, I mean, Derrick Rose and guys like that, Greg Oden, who all had good tournament runs. Absolutely. This year, Tyreke Evans led Memphis in. You look around, Blake Griffin was a guy who could potentially jump. There are a few guys as you look around the country.
Kevin Durant last year.
Yeah, Durant didn't go real far in the tournament, but you know, I think there are a few guys out there who at least make the argument make a little bit of sense.
There's also the players who play fairly well in college that would have mistakenly made the jump.
Exactly.
To the NBA.
No, one of those guys who is actually a junior right now, Paul Harris on Syracuse, when he came in as a freshman, he would have jumped. Like they were talking about maybe he was going to jump to the NBA, and he ended up staying because his game was so unpolished and needed so much work because he's so raw athletically that they thought he was athletic enough to play in the NBA. But, you know, maybe a guy like Thabeet goes straight to the NBA, even though he's very raw, just based on potential alone. Mm-hmm. Or maybe a guy like DeJuan Blair. I know there was talk like he may have went if there was no rule, and he ended up staying 2 years now and probably increased his draft stock. So, I don't know. There are guys where you never really know what was going to happen, and that might contribute to what we're seeing.
And just in general, you're not a fan of that rule, of the one-year in college minimum rule.
No, it's a terrible rule. I think everyone loses. I wrote like a column about this last summer where I just don't feel like anybody wins that situation. I feel like the fans and the program lose because you don't get to see your guys play for 3-4 years and really build something and have a good team chemistry. You're getting these one-and-done mercenaries who come in. I feel like the players lose out because they're first forced to go to college where they don't want to be anyway, and they're just using it as a stepping stone, and they could be making money for some of their families, stuff like that. And I feel like the universities lose and the teachers because they have these kids in class who have no business being there, who don't want to get a degree. I feel like the NBA loses because you don't get these kids in the NBA right away. The only argument you can make is that the college basketball level of play is slightly higher. But I don't think that's enough for to counteract everything else.
And then we, the NCAA tournament watchers, lose as well because we're not getting that March Madness we're so used to in the past.
Right.
Getting back to this year's tournament a little bit, you mentioned you were really embarrassed for Arizona. I was really embarrassed for Memphis with their game against Missouri.
Well, if you listen to this podcast at all, I've been telling you Memphis was not as good as people were saying they were, and they proved that. And, you know, one of the things, and Gonzaga I bought into, but they fall into the next point I'm trying to make too, is that Memphis came in, and Hubert Davis, if you listen to him on ESPN, is the best defensive team in the nation. They had the best opposing field goal percentage in the nation. They lock people down. But they're playing against CUSA, which is like slightly better competition than Southwest pickup games. So, of course, they're going to lock those guys down just with their athleticism. And as I'm watching that game, you know, and of course, I'm loving the fact that Memphis is losing and getting blown out the whole game. And Missouri drops 100 on them. They scored 100 points on supposedly the best defensive team in the nation. Unbelievable. And Gonzaga came in, I believe, second in that stat. of opposing field goal percentage, and they let up 98 to UNC today. So don't get, like, stats are all relative, and for these teams who have a much easier schedule because of the conference they're playing in, of course they're going to hold these little teams to much lower point totals and much lower field goal percentage. So you got to adjust and at least have some common sense there. And to say, like, Memphis is just so much better than everyone else defensively is completely ridiculous. And somebody who gets paid a lot of money to analyze college basketball couldn't have gotten that more wrong.
And so you think Memphis fell victim to the same problem as Arizona did in the first two rounds? They played lower, you know, mid-major schools, and then Memphis comes up against a big boy like Missouri, and they
part of the problem too. And I kept saying that they were so young this year, and they didn't have that veteran leadership that they had last season to complement their talent. And Missouri plays a really up-tempo style of game. They like to get out and run, push the ball. They don't milk the shot clock at all. They just want to go out there. And they athletically match up with Memphis. And I think Memphis's younger players who weren't disciplined enough, like Tyreke Evans, guys like that, thought, oh, this is fun. Like, we can get out. We can run up and down the floor. We don't have to worry about half-court sets. There's going to be a lot of transition plays. And that's exactly what Missouri wanted to. They weren't disciplined enough to try to slow the game down. You saw Marquette give Missouri a really great game that ended up under 70 points. It was in the 60s that game because they tried to slow the pace of play down, not play Missouri's game. Memphis wasn't disciplined enough to do that, and they just couldn't hang with them. They got ran out of the gym.
It's all very good points. And going back to your thing, I wouldn't say I'm embarrassed for them. I'm more angry at them because I had them in the Final Four. So.
Yes. I wanted to beat all of our Alligator listeners and Alligator people who signed up for our bracket challenge, because I had Memphis going to the championship game, and it was very disappointing to see them really not in the game at all. They cut it down to 8 points toward the end and made it seem like it was a game, but Memphis really was never in it at all. And they can't shoot free throws down the stretch, so they didn't stand a chance of making shots when they were getting fouled.
Discipline is so big at this time of the year, and making sure that you play the style of play that you want to play. Otherwise, bad things are going to happen to you. And that's what I felt like watching the Gonzaga game today, who I was really strongly pulling for. They have six guys on that team, their first six guys on the depth chart, that shoot the three pretty well for a high percentage. And UNC was just letting them, you know, like, they would contest the shot, but the three-point look was there most times, even if it wasn't, like, completely wide open. And Gonzaga was more than willing to just settle for a couple passes around the arc and then a three, and they didn't attack the basket, and they didn't get any easy looks. They didn't get any penetrations and kickouts for wide open looks from three, and I just felt like they were way too happy to take a slightly contested three-pointer just because they have pretty good three-point shooters, and they couldn't match up with UNC, who was just way too physical for them. So whoever can make the other team play their style of play, I think, is going to benefit greatly in these last few rounds.
All right, how did that happen in the Oklahoma-Syracuse game? Because I was all about Syracuse going in there. I was drinking the orange juice, as we joked.
The six overtimes definitely swayed a lot of brackets to pick Syracuse to go far in this tournament.
Well, I was one of them. I had them in the Final Four.
I wasn't too big on Syracuse. I had them going exactly where they went. But I think heading into that matchup, one of the things you heard was Oklahoma has a much better front court. They got Blake Griffin, who was an absolute monster. And then Syracuse has a little bit of a better backcourt and better wing players who can spread the floor on Oklahoma, so which was going to win out. And Syracuse went 0 for 10 from 3 in the first half. You already know they're a horrible free throw shooting team. They're one of the worst free throw shooting teams of the really good schools in the tournament. And they just couldn't, you know, they couldn't put the ball in the basket ultimately, because Oklahoma didn't play that well in the first half, and they were still up by double digits going into halftime. It was really Blake Griffin, a little bit of Tony Crocker, not much else. I just feel like Andy Rottins gave them nothing in the first half. I think he was 0 for 6 from 3. They just couldn't turn it on. They couldn't do anything to stop Blake Griffin. So
Who won out backcourt, you know, Syracuse's backcourt or Oklahoma's front court was a good point. And I completely bought into Defer made the point a lot. Like, it's all about guard play this tournament. It's all about guard play. And then it came back and, you know, didn't do me too well there. So.
And now we're left with an Elite Eight of number one Louisville against number two Michigan State. We've got number one Pittsburgh against number three Villanova. Number one, North Carolina against number two, Oklahoma, and number one, UConn against number three, Missouri. So how do we see that shaking out? Louisville, Michigan State. I have Michigan State beating Wake Forest because that's who I predicted to get this far. But Louisville is just running all over teams, and I would be very surprised to see Louisville get dropped by Michigan State, who struggled to get past Kansas on Friday night.
Yeah, the Michigan State-Kansas game was really just a who gets to get beat by Louisville game, as far as I'm concerned. So I actually have Louisville there. I had my eventual winners. So.
Yeah, I have Louisville winning the whole thing, so I obviously like them here. Plus, I want to get somebody in the Final Four, right? So
Pittsburgh, Villanova. I know you said you have a lot riding on this game, Kyle. Pittsburgh, I have winning the national championship. Now I feel like an idiot for doing that because they played terrible. The game against Xavier, Adam and I were sitting and watching that in the office and watching LeVance Field throw up that terrible contested three-pointer that somehow miraculously went in to win that game, essentially for them, put them ahead.
Yeah, well, but he's their big shot guy, and honestly, he's going to be the guy who takes those kind of shots. He's made a lot of them, and I mean, it went in. I respect the guy. He's a crunch time player. But yeah, I got Villanova. I'm really pleased with the way they've looked so far this tournament. They've, since the first half against American in the first round to the last five halves of basketball, they've been absolutely great, just dominating their opponents. So I feel good about it, but like I said, I got a lot riding on it. And I could, Pitt's got some talented players. They could definitely win.
I want to go back to that game where we were watching in the office. Like, when he took that shot, we both just screamed at the TV, like, what are you doing? Like, this
is stupid. Yeah, what an idiot. That's a terrible shot. Why would you take that shot?
And that's while it's in the air. Then it goes in, and we're both just celebrating all over the office.
Leap out of our chairs and screaming. The rest of the non-sports-related newsroom is wondering what the hell's going on in there.
We really ran the gamut of emotions on that one play. So
one more thing about that matchup, too. These two teams played only once during the regular season because the Big East has so many teams. They didn't meet in the tournament. And Villanova beat them by 10 and held Pittsburgh to 57 points. So I don't know if I like that or not for Villanova, because you kind of think Pittsburgh's going to come back motivated. It's hard to beat a good team more than once. So I don't know. I could see the game going either way, honestly.
I am not confident at all in my pick, the Pitt Panthers.
Yeah.
Villanova, you know, handled Duke very easily, it seemed like, Thursday night. So I would not be surprised to see the number 3 Villanova Wildcats go into the next round.
I'll do that. Let's move on.
Possibly the best game would be North Carolina-Oklahoma. A lot of people have Oklahoma going, including you, Kyle, and you're shaking your head now. Because of Ty Lawson.
I mean, I'm so upset. I stuck with UNC the whole entire year. Preseason, I said that they would win, and Roy Williams just completely freaked me out with all the stuff he was saying about Ty Lawson's ankle and how he couldn't do anything in practice, and he's doubtful for the game and all this other stuff, and Ty Lawson, if you watch him today, he dominated that first half. He was absolutely incredible.
He looks like one of the best players in the country.
Hands down. If they play like they played against Gonzaga, no team can beat them. The way they shot the ball was just incredible. Wayne Ellington's just – he hit 1-3 in the first half where he put it through his leg, stepped back, and just nailed it in somebody's face. And Hansborough had another big game. I do think Blake Griffin – there's nobody on UNC who can guard Blake Griffin. I promise you that. So that will be the one thing that keeps Oklahoma probably in the game. But if they get hot and just start dumping in these threes from the outside, and Ty Lawson gets wherever he wants to on the court, there's no one who can beat them, and I don't feel good about my Oklahoma pick with Ty Lawson playing the way he is.
I'll agree. I think right now the way UNC is playing, they're going to the championship game and probably losing to Louisville. I don't know. That would be a ridiculous game. But, I mean, it will be interesting to see how Blake Griffin plays in that game. He's the only thing that can keep him in there, I think.
And there's a lot of UNC haters out there, just like there's a lot of Duke haters out there, and there's especially a large number of Tyler Hansborough haters. I don't know how much people will enjoy watching him get manhandled by Blake Griffin down low all game, because that's what's going to happen.
Did you guys watch the game today, the Oklahoma-Syracuse game?
Parts of it, because it's such a blowout, it's hard to keep watching.
Did you see Blake Griffin hit his head on the backboard?
No.
Oh, my God. Okay, there's this one play. It was towards the end of the game. He should have been out of the game anyway, because it was well in hand. You don't want to risk injury to him. The guard gets penetration. He's sitting, like, baseline, maybe, like, 10 feet up the baseline from the hoop. And the guard dumps it off to him. He's got a clear path to the basket. You see him just take off, take flight, like throw down a nasty dunk. He hits his head on the side of the backboard as he's attacking the rim from the side. And he, like, you know, slammed it home viciously. But as he was coming back down court, he's holding his head and stuff like that. One of the craziest things I've ever seen. Like, these guys just get so far above the rim. It's amazing.
This is the same guy who got hurt his back or something early in the season, then dove into the crowd.
Yeah, the next game.
The very next
game.
Yeah, and then he had to sit out a couple games with a concussion, too. And he just slammed his head into the side of the backboard. So I hope he's, you know, I'm sure he's fine. He played more minutes after that, but He's taken a lot of punishment throughout the season. I've gained a lot of respect for him.
He seems to have no regard for his own safety. He definitely plays the game as hard as it can be played.
Reckless abandon at Blake Griffin. Also, I did see he had a nasty dunk at one point. It was a fast break, and he just threw down the dirtiest dunk on a fast break and then came down with no emotion on his face. That, to me, was disappointing. I feel like, you know,
Think that was that after Johnny Flynn missed his dunk?
Yeah.
Because it was late in the game, and Johnny Flynn gets in the lane, just elevates, hangs in the air forever. The guy's like maybe 6 feet and tries to slam it home over one of UNC's forward and clanked it off the back iron. Blake Griffin goes the other way, shows him how it's done. But
well, it helps when you're a foot taller.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's Good point.
And
all right.
The final matchup in the Elite Eight will be UConn, Missouri, and I really have no idea what to expect from this game because Missouri just outplayed Memphis so completely, but Memphis, as Kyle said, got exposed a little bit, so I really don't know what to feel about Missouri.
I won't tell you what to feel. I actually have this region perfect so far, so trust me on this one. UConn's going to win. I said coming in to the tournament, I didn't really love UConn so much. I just felt like there was nobody who was going to beat them in that bracket, and I still feel that way. I think that Missouri's front court is undersized. DeMar Carroll plays a power forward for them. He's like 6'7". He's a very physical player. But Thabeet is going to change a lot of his shots, and they don't have anyone to match up with Thabeet, I don't think. And A.J. Price has just been great at point guard for them. They got guys like Jeff Adrian on that team, too. So I just think UConn's going to be a little bit too much for them to handle, and I think they roll over Missouri fairly easily.
Yeah, I agree. I think most of Missouri's ease over Memphis was what Kyle talked a little bit earlier. Memphis, you know, just was not the defensive powerhouse they were hyped up to be. So I like UConn in that game
as
well.
If Thabeet gets into foul trouble, though, it'll
be
a completely different game. But, I mean, that always goes without saying. If DeJuan Blair gets into foul trouble, Blake Griffin gets into foul trouble, any of these big players get into foul trouble, it's going to change the game.
All right, so there's your Elite Eight.
All right, from there, we're going to move on, talk a little bit about football spring practice. Evan, you've been at the festivities these last few days. How do you feel about them?
Football spring practice started up on Wednesday, and there was another session on Friday. I enjoy football practice starting back up in the spring. I know there's not a lot of important stuff to be gained or learned from it, but I think UF coach Urban Meyer does certainly get a feel for his younger players who didn't play at all last season, the redshirt freshmen like Earl Okine, a defensive end who did not touch the field at all in the 2008 season. Players like that, or even the sophomores and freshmen who played sparingly, you kind of get a feel for where they are physically and mentally before the summer break and before the football season. Meyer talked a lot about, after practice on Friday, about how you earn your spots in August in April. In April is where you earn your August spots. So he at least really believes that things get done in spring practice. They do a lot of experimental stuff. They did some direct snaps to Emmanuel Moody today in practice just because Jeff Demps is with the track and field team in Tallahassee over the weekend. So Emmanuel Moody got a lot of touches in practice. But today's session was particularly interesting, and by today I mean Friday. We're dealing with this time machine issue again. whenever you listen to it, Friday's session was interesting because it was pouring rain. I was fortunate enough to remember to bring an umbrella, so I was one of maybe five media members out there for the entire spring practice. Watching them play, a lot of other people went underneath the football stadium itself and waited for the practice to end so we could talk to Coach Meyer. But, it was fun to see them do the 7-on-7 scrimmages in the pouring rain and have Brandon Spikes make a ridiculous interception after it being bobbled three times by different players and then him landing in the mud with a thud. And, seeing Carl Moore make a ridiculous one-armed catch despite it being soaking wet and him being covered very, very well by a D-back. So, you know, it's just cool to see things like that happen. And also Caleb Sturgis drilling a 52-yard field goal in the pouring rain. So, you know, you kind of get a feel for that. Caleb Sturgis, by the way, is getting a little bit of the short end of the stick by Jonathan Phillips, getting an extra year of eligibility. Caleb Sturgis was the clear choice for the next field goal kicker. He's a sophomore now from St. Augustine. But with Jonathan Phillips staying for an extra year for his redshirt senior season, Sturgis will be probably riding the bench again just because Phillips has been the man. He was very good last year, only missed one field goal.
But you wrote a column earlier this week, and you said you just like, you know, that spring practice is here. You just like that it exists, basically, you know, end of basketball season. It's something to look forward to, you know, other than the sports Kyle and I cover, baseball and softball. So talk a little bit about that.
The spring practice was perfect this year because the men's and women's basketball teams ended their seasons on Tuesday night, and then Wednesday night spring football practice started right back up, and the fans were loving it. There were so many people there on Wednesday. Unbelievable. There was probably 3 to 4 times as many people with the media there as on a normal spring practice day just because it was the start of it. There was ESPN present with a camera and a really huge boom microphone sticking on the above Urban Meyer's head during the post-practice interviews. It was just, you could feel it in the air that there was something magical going on in the UF practice field with the fans and the whole thing was, you know, UF football is back. Even if there's no actual games or anything terribly important being decided, the fans loved it. They were out in droves and they came to see their teams play without pads.
Kyle, you're outraged. What do you have to say?
I can't stand spring practice. I mean, I think it has benefit for the team and for Coach Meyer and stuff like that. And what Evan was saying about Urban saying that you earn your spots in August and April. I think that's half true and half a bunch of crap because, I mean, so a lot of the players, a lot of the freshmen who are going to make impacts right away, like Andre DeBose, they're not even here yet participating. So what happens when they come in and take a spot away from somebody? I think there is some truth to that at positions where it's like senior guys battling, but it's the notion of whatever's going on now is going to be relevant 3-4 months from now. We just don't know. And the thing that drives me absolutely insane the most are the injury reports. Because if it's a serious injury report, like somebody has a, you know, an ACL tear, something that's going to take a long, long time to rehab, I get that. That's big news. If somebody tweaks an ankle and has to sit out that practice, or these little injuries that we hear about that people come back with as news or put in their injury reports in their notebooks, I'm sure they'll heal up come opening day. Like, take it from me, they will.
The perfect example of that is the Brandon James foot surgery. He broke his foot. He had a little stress fracture thing, and he's going to be out for 2 more weeks.
Oh, two weeks? How will he ever get back in time?
He won't be back until April 11th or so. He'll miss like 5 more spring practice sessions. So yeah, I completely understand what you're saying with injury reports. Those are ridiculous.
Yeah, the injury reports drive me absolutely insane. And the fanfare, I don't understand. I think it's because I like all sports so much. And during tournament time, I shut everything down. It's only the tournament that's going on for me right now, pretty much. But I don't understand how people come out to watch people take drills with their helmets on and no pads against, you know, dummies or whatever they're doing out there, 7-on-7 drills. I mean, that's all cool, whatever. And then I have to come back and listen to guys who were at the practice tell me how Tebow didn't look so good today. It's like, oh, I'm real concerned. Like, are they going to sit him and put Brantley in for the first game? Like, it's just all ridiculous. They're just shaking off the rust. They're just getting out there and running around. It's not a big deal.
And the fans who come out, they really do love this football team beyond anything. I'd say that most of them love it beyond anything in life because they came out on Friday afternoon in the pouring rain, wearing raincoats, sitting down on the little tiny bleacher section that they have set up out there. And they did not move. They sat there with umbrellas or in raincoats, and they watched Tim Tebow throw the ball a little bit, and they watched Brennan Spikes play a little defense, and that was magical, as
Evan said. But I like the orange and blue game. I think the orange and blue game actually is cool, and that's something that I would go out and watch, and I think it's fun to see them play against each other and see them be competitive within one another. But come out in your raincoat and sit down and watch them just, you know, mess around, essentially, is just a little much for me. I don't want, you know, the report of, like, Caleb Sturgis hit a 52-yarder in the rain, like, with no rush or any defense. It's like, that's great. Like, great job, Caleb Sturgis. I don't really know what to make of that come football season. And also with a team that's this well-established, you pretty much know what you're going to get for next year and who's going to be playing for the most part. There are a few positions that are up for grabs, but spring practice drives me absolutely nuts, especially more hearing about spring practice than spring practice itself.
So this conversation drives you nuts.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd say it's more just about giving the fans, you know, something to look forward to. The fans have to be happy about something. They're clearly not happy about the basketball teams here. I mean, they don't come out to watch their number one softball team play, so they got to look forward to something.
I disagree with that. I was at a softball game on Saturday, and fan support was huge.
Yeah, it was for softball, it's good, but
yeah, exactly.
But, yeah, I just don't... It's hard for me to understand, but with college sports, people really become fans of their teams, not so much of sports in general.
Yeah.
So they like the big sport. They like football and basketball, and they just watch the Gators play those two sports. Whereas, you know, maybe somebody who's a sports fan anyway, if the Gators aren't in, that's okay. You know, basketball season goes on without the Gators. Maybe getting a little NBA action. If you're really deprived, getting some NHL stuff. It's
Kyle.
But, like... this notion of, like, watching Brandon Spikes run around in shorts out there. What was the quote from Urban Meyer? John Brantley looks great in shorts. all right, that's cool. Like, let's see how he looks under center with the pads on in a rush. Like, it drives me insane. Go follow the softball team who's going to try to make a run at the title this year. Go follow the baseball team who's doing pretty well. Look into some other stuff. Take this time to get to know UF a little bit better.
Gymnastics, national championships, and regionals coming up soon. The men's swimming and diving team is in the national championship this weekend. There's a lot of stuff going on besides football spring practice.
Jeff Dent's running track now.
Exactly. Yeah. He's in Florida State Relays in Tallahassee this weekend.
I want to ask you, like, what kinds of fans are showing up? Are these mostly students, or are they the older fans, or what kind of crowd are you getting? Good mix?
I think it's a pretty solid mix. You're going to have the, I don't know if anyone out there watches Friday Night Lights, but you're going to have the Buddy Garrity's of the world, the older booster people who give money, donate lots of money to the program, and they're going to sit there and watch the, you know, their money hard at work kind of thing.
What are you trying to say, Evan?
Their money, not their players. That's not at all what I meant. You took that the wrong way. That is not at all what I meant. But yeah, there's those kinds of people. But then there's a fair amount of students who live in Murfree and have nothing better to do at 4 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon, and they're going to go out and watch Tim Tebow, their idol, throw the ball around.
I'd rather play a game of NCAA with the Gators than go out and watch them play. I'd rather have somebody come back and tell me that Tim Tebow scored 10 touchdowns in their NCAA game than he overthrew a couple receivers in spring practice.
He overthrew someone so bad today because he was running backward and he threw off his back foot and it was raining. The ball went like 5 yards out of bounds. And some fan caught it, and that had to be the happiest moment of that fan's life because they just caught a perfect spiral from Timmy Tebow.
And Urban Meyer dropped him behind John Brilley on the depth chart.
Zach O'Quinn is now the number one quarterback on the team. None of you have probably ever heard of Zach O'Quinn, but I assure you he is a real quarterback on the Gators roster.
Kyle, I was going to say with the NCAA thing, we actually get both that and spring practice reports from photo editor Harrison Diamond. We get both reports. His big Gators exploits.
Yeah, Harrison, who is a loyal listener, is currently on his 2021 season of NCAA Football 09 because that's what he does all day. And we love him for it because he tells us about Danny Werfel's son, who is now his Heisman-winning quarterback, and it's always fun to listen to him go on about his NCAA football teams, which he loves dearly.
Approximately as interesting to me as hearing about actual spring practice.
Approximately,
yeah. All right, Kyle, tell us a little bit about the baseball team's weekend series. They started off with a 11-4 win against Alabama at home Friday night, right?
The baseball team was in action tonight. They opened up a series with Alabama. They did win 11-4, like you said. Alabama actually jumped on them early, 4-0 after four innings. The starter for UF today was Jeff Barfield, who has been probably their most dependable pitcher, but he really struggled today and only lasted three innings. UF didn't get on the board until the fifth inning and fought their way back. They didn't take the lead until the seventh when they went up 5-4, and then they tacked on a ton of insurance runs in the eighth. They scored six more, really opened it up. Clint Franklin really did a great job in relief of Barfield. He's been a great long relief type guy for them. He came in and gave them four innings, struck out six batters, was very effective, didn't let up any runs, got the win. His ERA is under two for the season now, so he's done a really good job. And Bullock came in at the end and shut the door. So
I checked the scoreboard on that game a little earlier in the evening, and am I crazy or did it say one run allowed in each of the first four innings for UF? Like they had 1-1-1-1.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, one run allowed in each of the first four. So
that's just weird to see on the scoreboard.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting, a little different. But it was a good win for them, I think, because Alabama's a pretty solid team. Not, like, great, but definitely not a pushover. Tennessee, like, if we're being honest, was a little bit of a pushover, so sweeping them wasn't exactly big news. But getting a win against Alabama and keeping their, good play up was big. And the other thing that was huge for them today was no errors. I honestly don't remember the last time they had no errors, and there's always a few infield errors, it seems like, every single game. So no errors for them. They got a couple big hits. Buddy Monroe had another big game for them at the plate. Preston Tucker had a big game, hit a couple doubles. So.
And Alabama has a big home run hitter who was kept completely off the board.
Kent Mathis, he got a hit today, but didn't do any significant damage, didn't hit any home runs. But, yeah, coming into the series, he had 15 home runs. The Gators' entire team had 15 home runs. So he might drop a couple bombs in the next couple games, but he didn't hurt him today.
And they play Saturday and Sunday?
Saturday and Sunday. They're playing on Saturday. Nick Marunda is going to get the start for them. On Sunday, I'm not sure who's starting. You'll probably see either Stephen Locke or Patrick Keating, though, if I had to guess.
How long until Stephen Locke is a weekend starter? Because I can't imagine him staying off the weekend rotation for very long.
No, I mean, you could see, even though he only threw two innings in his debut for them, how much of an actual pitcher he is. Like, well, they have so many young guys who go up there. And they try to, they're not entirely comfortable on the mound. They don't necessarily know which pitch to go to. They maybe get a little rattled easily. Locke looked just so poised. You could tell he was a veteran. He knew exactly what his out pitch was, how to set it up. He had a plan on the mound. He was very calm and composed. And you could just tell that he's a really good guy to have up there pacing the team.
And he only went two innings in his first outing strictly because he was on a pitch count.
Yeah,
it's not like he was performing poorly late in that second inning and they pulled him. But he was absolutely their second best pitcher in last season behind Patrick Keating, who was kind of underwhelming this year, so I can't imagine Locke staying out off the weekend for much longer.
No, I think he'll definitely find his way back in. But the way O'Sullivan manages this team is he's just putting out whoever he feels is available and gives them the best chance at that moment. There's no such thing as roles on this team. I mean, you've seen some guys emerge, but if they were to struggle, he'd switch it up in a second. He's not like sticking with guys just for the sake of sticking with guys because of what he thinks their role should have been prior to the season and stuff like that. You've seen a lot of the starters come out of the bullpen. You've seen a guy, Jeff Barfield, who's projected to be the closer, be a starter. You've seen all kinds of stuff from him.
Lead-off hitting, switching.
Yeah, he's moving everybody around in every different position. And I think, in a way, that's good. It kind of keeps things fresh for the guys. And it's really like more of a team environment, I think. You don't always have to like rely on hopefully this one or two guys are going to be great and carry the team.
All right, so keep an eye on that series throughout the weekend. Speaking of Alabama, the softball team, which we mentioned earlier, is also playing Alabama this weekend at home, a three-game series. Alabama was the number two team in the country. They lost twice to LSU in a doubleheader earlier this week, so now it's number one versus number four. I mean, it's still probably the biggest series of the year for UF, right, Kyle? I mean,
no question. It's the biggest series.
If you're going to go to a series, go this weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. This is definitely the biggest series of the year. I mean, it'll be bigger for a one game if they play them in the SEC Championship again.
Yeah.
But no question at all, this is the biggest series for them. Alabama, it will probably be back to the College World Series again this year as they were last year. Two great teams with great pitching, great hitting. It's just I'd like to go out and watch it, honestly.
All right, so keep an eye on that as well. And we're going to move on to our final segment here. We're going to give out our Reggie Nelson Awards for Excellence in the Field of Sport and our Kyle Jackson Bad Angles of the Week. Evan, you were not here when we gave out our first annual awards, I guess. So.
Annual. Podcastual or weekly. I don't know how it works. But, yeah, I missed out on the first one, so here you go. My positive award, the Reggie Nelson Award for Excellence in the Field of Sport. I get that right.
Well done.
Yeah, all right. That one goes to former NBA superstar Bill Walton for leaving the greatest answering machine happy birthday message I've ever heard in my life. He was leaving
on your phone?
No, not on my phone. I was just getting to that. He left a message on the phone of Harvey Pollack, who was the former statistics director for the Philadelphia 76ers, I believe. He's in his 80s, and Walton just left this rambling, nonsensical message for 2 minutes, and it was wonderful to listen to. He was splicing in him singing happy birthday with actual sentences, yeah, and the highlight of it comes here. Quote, "You make our lives so wonderful, so full, so complete, and you're such an intergalactic treasure."
Oh my God.
End quote. If that's not classic Bill Walton, I don't know what is. That made my day when I heard that answering machine message. You try to find that online if you can, because it's great to listen to.
We'll link to it in the show notes, actually, so you can give that a listen. Yeah. I'm hoping my birthday is Tuesday. I'm just throwing that out there. Bill Walton, if you want to give me a call, I'm available.
But you know, Bill Walton was a child of the 60s, and he was a big hippie guy, so Lord knows the type of drugs that's ran through his system.
Yeah. So enough to make him say intergalactic treasure to describe a former statistics director for, I don't know how he made their lives so full and so complete, but Bill Walton, you're such a good guy, so you get my Reggie Nelson Award for Excellence in the Field of Sport for this week.
And your Kyle Jackson Bad Angle of
my
the Week?
My Kyle Jackson Bad Angle of the Week. Going a little high up on the list, I'm going to President of the United States of America, Barack Obama, for making ESPN show us constantly his bracket choices. President Barack Obama, I voted for you, but I don't care who you picked in your brackets. I don't care if you picked UNC. I don't want to hear your updates, and I don't want to see a link to it on ESPN.com's front page and on the bottom line every day. There's got to be an NHL score that you can get to before I know that Barack Obama's Sweet 16 pick just lost. So, Barack Obama, you're great, but I don't want to hear who you picked in the brackets.
All right, Kyle?
Well, my Reggie Nelson Excellence in the Field of Sport Award goes to the Big East Conference in basketball. They've been lauded as the best conference all season long. Coach K had something to say about he thought the ACC was a better conference. Clearly not the case. Four of the eight elite eight teams come from the Big East, including a Pitt-Villanova matchup, but it's an all-Big East matchup. And they've really done a great job and shown that they are, in fact, the best conference in basketball this season.
And Coach K did lose to a Big East team.
He didn't just lose. He got whooped. So Coach K kind of got put in his place there. The Big East have produced the most exciting teams to watch, too, in my opinion. So There you go. And my Kyle Jackson bad angle of the week goes to a couple of college coaches, and for the sake of equality, a men's and a women's coach. My men's coach is going to be Roy Williams of North Carolina for completely misleading me on Ty Lawson's injury and the rest of the nation. And I fear that UNC is going to win, and I will no longer be able to claim any credit for that. So, Roy, I'm very disappointed in you. You may have tricked me. Hopefully you tricked the opposition too, so it was worth it. My women's coach is, of course, Pat Summitt. Again, we're going to go right to the top. We only go at the big names here at Alligator Sports.
Barack Obama and Pat Summitt.
Pat Summitt did the most ridiculous thing I maybe have ever seen from a coach. This trumps Billy Donovan pulling his players out of the practice facility and taking away their Gators gear and stuff like that. Pat Summitt, after her team lost in the first round of the NCAA tournament, which is the first time they've ever done that since she's been there, I believe the first time they've ever lost before the Sweet 16 since she's been there.
I think so.
But she had her team practice the next day. Unbelievable. If I was a player on that team, I would hate her so much. And I know a lot of people who I'm friends with said, oh, this is so good. Look at Pat Summitt. She's saying that she expects more out of her players. This is so ridiculous. This isn't helping your players at all. They have a whole, a lot of time off here to correct whatever they want to correct. There's going to be new players coming in. There's a lot of turnover off a team that won a national championship. I just can't respect a coach who goes out and does something like this. And I think Pat Summitt is a great coach, but I don't understand this coaching move. I think it's really just unfair to the players, and I would hate her for it if I was playing on the team.
All right, and we're going to round out the awards. We've said we're going for the top here. Stay tuned for my Kyle Jackson. It doesn't get much higher than I'm going to go with that.
Higher than Barack Obama, even, possibly.
Possibly.
Around these parts, anyway.
Okay, at least. But I will give my Reggie Nelson Award for Excellence in the Field of Sport to an equally bizarre candidate, none other than Dennis Rodman.
The Worm.
The Worm. All right, and I'm going to explain this. This is a little bit of a story. I get a random text from my brother that says, I'm 3 feet away from Dennis Rodman. First of all, I thought he was home. I had no idea why Dennis Rodman was in Clearwater, Florida.
Dennis Rodman was robbing your brother.
As it turns out, he's in Miami. He's at a Hard Rock or something. He's performing with a club band. And my brother's like, oh, and he's awesome, by the way. Or he's doing pretty well. Kind of surprising. So then he comes over to the table. He shakes their hand or something. My brother said he was looking for the largest bottle of hand sanitizer he could possibly find after shaking Rodman's hand.
Oh.
And then Rodman goes over to another table and just starts, making conversation with some women,
right.
trying to work the worm charm there. And then just that's such a surreal thing to me, that people like Dennis Rodman exist. They can do anything, and nothing surprises you from, it's like Mike Tyson.
The Mike Tyson zone.
It's in the
from
Tyson
Bill
zone.
Simmons. You believe any story you hear about those type of people.
Exactly.
Like Dennis Rodman could do literally anything, and everyone would believe any story about them. So.
And that's why I give my my Reggie Nelson Award to Dennis Rodman for just being Dennis Rodman. All right, and then much anticipated, I'm giving my Kyle Jackson bad angle of the week to Tim Tebow.
How dare you? I'm aghast.
We just lost 20 listeners.
I'm getting so much hate
so
mail.
So now we're at negative 50.
Oh, no. Oh, no. I'm getting hate mail for this, but I'll clarify. It's not necessarily him. He's obviously a great person. We obviously know he does great things. But what he's become, he's been given a very long leash. He has, a lot of clout. He can do some stuff, say, for example, take a softball beat writer's seat in the softball press box.
Bitter much?
Not at all. I was sitting outside with you people.
You people. The commoners.
I'm saying you people because Evan was there at that softball game that I was sitting outside. But yeah, I was outside. It was actually nice. I liked being, involved in that.
You were in the shade.
Yeah, I was in the shade, fortunately, which you and your sunburned face cannot say.
No.
But I walk up into the press box to get food, and I'm like, okay, I understand it's a big series, a lot of media there, and there's a radio person sitting where I usually sit. And then next to me, where other beat writers usually sit, is none other than Tim Tebow. And so I was thinking, okay, we're sitting outside. I understand he's, he can't really go out and sit in the stands or whatever. But then next to him are his friends and, some
entourage.
His entourage, if you will.
It's a little, I don't think that's cool in any way, shape, or form. I mean, the press box is supposed to be, a working media place, and he's not exactly working media.
Not exactly.
But it's not like it's a suite, the press box. It's supposed to be working media, like we say. So,
and of all the people who get kicked out, poor Adam, who's there every day covering that softball team, maybe only one or two other people can say.
Yeah, right. just me and one other writer there. But it was still enjoyable, but still, the principle of it all leads me to give my Kyle Jackson bad angle of the week to Tim Tebow.
Kind of on the same note, last week we gave you some ridiculous, we knew Tim Tebow was out of hand when this happened stories.
Exactly.
We got another one because the Alligator office, which we love so much, our home away from home, is located very closely to Gator Dogs, which is a delicious dining establishment right around the corner.
Dining establishment.
It was getting a little bit late, and I was wondering if they were still open because I was going to make the trek and go pick up a Gator Dog. And I checked their menu online and stuff. I couldn't find their hours anywhere, surprisingly, on their website, but I did find this. There was a page that was titled, I believe, like, just Tebow. Tebow 15 was the title of the page, and I clicked on it, and it took me to this page of just Tebowisms. This is a restaurant that has no apparent link to Tebow.
They sell almost exclusively hot dogs.
Think about how ridiculous it was. I couldn't find their hours on their webpage, but I did find a list of 25 to 30 Tebowisms that the owner thought was cool. The owner's a really cool guy. He's always there, and he serves everyone. He's a nice dude. I'm not
great
trying to
guy.
Hate on him, but it's just that was one of the moments where it's like, okay, Tebow's officially out of control.
By Tebowisms, you mean the typical Superman wears Tim Tebow pajamas, things like that?
Exactly, yeah. Things like that.
All of those. So that's now two Tim Tebow has gotten out of control stories in one show, just to back up our talk from the last one. But we're going to give out a show-wide Kyle Jackson bad angle of the week. To our own Phil Kegler, who, strangely enough, was the recipient of a Reggie Nelson Award last week. This one, though, is not going to Grandma Phil. This one's going to Dr. Phil Kegler. Phil Kegler, he was scheduled to be on the show tonight. We were really excited about having him on, having him talk a little bit about spring practice and his NCAA tournament picks.
I was mildly excited to be having him on.
Really excited. It's a little bit carried away there.
I was happy to
that's
have him.
That's
happy
as
to
carried away
here.
As me describing the spring football as magical.
All right, but then I get a text from Phil, and it says he's not going to be able to make it. And then in very much detail, this is why we're calling him Dr. Phil here, he says he was caught in the rain today, Friday, and cold in sandals and without an umbrella. Unlike you, Evan, who you had the...
Bring an umbrella, Phil. It works great.
And then the last sentence, the kicker here, he says, I'm fighting an oncoming respiratory infection. So they
Phil, not a med student. I'm just going to throw that out there.
He's going to law school, baby.
Not going to med school.
All right, and I think that wraps it up for our show. In all seriousness, we do want Phil to feel better, but, you know, I don't know, Kyle's shaking his head.
I mean, whatever. It's not going to bother me one way or another.
All right, that wraps it up. Send any feedback to sports@alligator.org. Comment on our blogs. Send feedback. We'll read it on the show. We didn't have anything to read today. But,
okay,
you know.
Here's a challenge for listeners out there.
Ooh.
Give us your Tim Tebow has gotten out of control moments. Anyone out there listening to the podcast, especially people who live in Gainesville and have lived here for the Tim Tebow era, send in stuff like the Gator Dog story where Tim Tebow has just reached every corner, every last corner of the Gainesville community, and we'll read a couple of them on the air if we get some emails. So
yeah.
Let us know.
It'll be like our question of the week. What's your, you know, Tim Tebow story? Tim Tebow has gotten out of control story. All right. And I guess with that, we're out.
Goodbye.